other piece of this is, the truth is it takes a while for the Department of Justice to put together charges. They have to investigate. They have to decide what can we prosecute? What could we get a guilty verdict on, et cetera. So it's just as plausible that it's not that the Department of Justice is waiting. It's that as the January 6th committee exposes possible criminality, the DOJ starts to investigate, and it can take a few months to put together what the charges are. Now, that's optimistically thinking. I still have seen no evidence that Merrick Garland actually wants to or is willing to charge anybody high level in the Trump administration up to and including Donald Trump. I've just seen no interest from him in doing that. And we'll continue to follow it. I hope that that is not the case, but I'm not feeling particularly optimistic about it. We'll talk on the bonus show today about the new images from the James Webb Space Telescope. Many of you requesting this story. Super interesting. New York City monkeypox cases have doubled again. Not good. And Jill Biden has now apologized after saying that Latinos are as unique as breakfast tacos. Very, very weird thing to say. And we will talk about it on the bonus show. Get instant access by signing up at joinpacman.com.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sound of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in techno land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT in Sound.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Now, as president, I'm proud to say that our relationship with the state of Israel is deeper and stronger, in my view, than it's ever been. And with this visit, we're strengthening our connections even further.
President Biden arrives to a rapturous welcome in Israel, vowing to deepen ties to the United States, even as he faces pressure to scrap plans to build a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, located on land confiscated by Israel from Palestinians in 1948. We'll speak with Palestinian-American scholar, Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi, a descendant of some of the owners of these properties, author of The Hundred Years' War on Palestine. After Israel, Biden heads to Saudi Arabia despite Biden's campaign pledge to make Saudi Arabia a pariah for the state-sponsored killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. We'll get response from Sarah Lee Whitson, lawyer for Khashoggi's fiancé.
Saudi Arabia is not going to make any human rights concessions because the United States is demanding it. It never has.
Then COVID-19 cases continue to rise as the BA.5 variant puts more people in the hospital amidst high rates of reinfection.
The Emergency Committee on COVID-19 met on Friday last week and concluded that the virus remains a public health emergency of international concern.
We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Ed Yong of The Atlantic about his new piece, Is BA.5 the Reinfection Wave? And we'll ask him about his new book, just out, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden arrived in Israel Wednesday for a four-day Middle East visit that includes a stop in Saudi Arabia. Israel's interim prime minister, Yair Lapid, held a red carpet ceremony as Biden landed at Ben-Gurion Airport, giving him what the New York Times called a rapturous welcome and calling him our brother Joseph. Before departing the airport, Biden toured a U.S.-funded advanced missile defense system. On Friday, Biden will visit the occupied West Bank and meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Ahead of Biden's trip, Biden activists hung banners in Bethlehem that read, "Mr. President, this is apartheid." Earlier today, Biden met with Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid in Jerusalem, where the pair discussed Iran's nuclear program and the war in Ukraine. The U.S. and Israel are expected to announce a joint declaration building on past calls to take military action to halt Iran's nuclear program. Biden's promised he won't agree to any deal that would restore the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, which the United States unilaterally withdrew from in 2018, if it means removing Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps from a list of foreign terrorist organizations. President Biden was asked about that pledge in a recorded interview with Israeli TV that aired Wednesday.
Are you committed to keep the IRGC on the foreign terrorist organization list, even if that means that kills the deal?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You, in the past, said you'll do anything, and you say it again, that you'll ensure Iran would not acquire nuclear weapons. Does that also mean, sir, that you would use force against Iran? Is that what that means?
That was the last resort, yes.
This weekend, President Biden will become the first U.S. president to visit Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, where he's scheduled to meet top Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. After headlines, we'll have more on President Biden's trip to Israel, the occupied Palestinian territories, and Saudi Arabia. The House of Representatives is set to vote this week on a record-shattering $839 billion military budget. The 2023 National Defense Authorization Act contains $37 billion more than President Biden requested, which in turn surpassed former President Trump's record military budget requests. Progressive Democrats Mark Pocan and Barbara Lee have proposed an amendment that would slash $100 billion from the military budget. Congressmember Lee said, quote, more guns and tanks are of no use to Americans without housing, education, or health care, she said. In Sri Lanka, one person was killed, scores of others injured after police used tear gas and water cannons to attack anti-government protests in the capital, Colombo. This comes after President Gotabaya Rajapaksa fled the country for the Maldives Wednesday, where he was met with protests. He's reportedly since left the Maldives aboard a Saudi airplane bound for Singapore, though it's not clear whether this is his final destination. Rajapaksa promised to resign by Wednesday, but has not yet done so. Ukrainian officials say at least 12 people were killed and more than two dozen injured after Russian missiles fell on an office building and homes in the central city of Vinnytsia. In southern Ukraine, Russian shells blasted a hole in a high-rise hotel in the city of Mykolaiv, where five people were reportedly killed by Russian shelling. In eastern Ukraine's Donetsk province, a Russian strike destroyed a school in the city of Kostyantynivka, leaving behind a massive crater. No one was injured in the attack, but students were left traumatized by the loss of their school.
Let this war end soon, and let everything be like it was before. Like before, when we all played together. Now they shell us. It is difficult to believe what's happening.
On Wednesday, negotiators from Russia and Ukraine held their first direct talk since March in Istanbul, Turkey, where they're reportedly nearing a deal that would allow Ukraine to export more than 20 million tons of grain from the Black Sea port city of Odessa. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the breakthrough a, quote, ray of hope to ease human suffering and alleviate hunger around the world. Abortion providers in South Carolina have filed a lawsuit seeking to block Senate Bill 1, the state's ban on abortion after just 6 weeks of pregnancy, when many people are not yet aware that they're pregnant. The challenge comes less than a month after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ending the federal constitutional right to abortion. In a statement, Planned Parenthood called the law a direct assault on health care and fundamental human rights, adding, quote, without court intervention, South Carolinians will continue to suffer in a state with dangerously high rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality, particularly among Black women and babies. A warning to our audience, this next story contains graphic descriptions of sexual violence. In Ohio, police have arrested a man accused of raping and impregnating a 10-year-old girl. 27-year-old Gerson Fuentes was arraigned in Columbus Wednesday and is being held on $2 million bond. Prosecutors say he confessed to raping the girl on at least two occasions. A police detective testified the 10-year-old survivor underwent a medical abortion in Indianapolis June 30th. Her family was forced to travel to the neighboring state because Ohio state law bans abortions just 6 weeks into pregnancy with no exceptions for rape or incest. This case drew international attention after it was first reported by the Indianapolis Star July 1st and was cited by President Biden as evidence of the cruelty of the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe. Many Republicans, including Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, questioned the validity of the story. Ohio Congressmember Jim Jordan tweeted, "Another lie, on anyone surprised?" Jordan's tweet was later deleted without explanation. On Monday, Ohio's Republican Attorney General Dave Yost went on Fox News to voice doubts, telling host Jesse Waters his office hadn't heard a whisper anywhere about the case.
The rape of a 10-year-old means life in prison. I know our prosecutors and cops in this state. There's not one of them that wouldn't be turning over every rock in their jurisdiction if they had the slightest hint that this had occurred there.
On Wednesday, Yost refused to apologize for questioning the girl's story on national television. The Justice Department's asked the House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol to turn over evidence it's collected about plans by Trump and his allies to put forward false slates of pro-Trump electors in battleground states won by Joe Biden in the 2020 election. This comes as a growing number of Democratic lawmakers are calling on Attorney General Merrick Garland to bring criminal charges against Trump based on the committee's findings. Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal tweeted, quote, all of it points to the urgent need for DOJ to prosecute Donald Trump. If he's not held accountable, there will be enormous consequences to our democracy, unquote. Meanwhile, a 48-year-old has been arrested in Seattle on suspicion of hate crime after he allegedly threatened to kill Congressmember Jayapal. Officers found the man outside Jayapal's home Saturday night with a .40-caliber handgun holstered on his waist. A neighbor reportedly overheard the man yell, quote, "Go back to India, I'm going to kill you," unquote. Jayapal is the first Indian-American woman to serve in the House of Representatives. And in Washington, D.C., parents of children murdered in Uvalde and survivors of the Highland Park mass shooting gathered at the U.S. Capitol Wednesday to demand a federal assault weapons ban. This is Kimberly Rubio, whose daughter, Lexi, was one of 19 fourth graders and their two teachers killed by an 18-year-old gunman with an assault rifle at Robb Elementary School in May.
But there is one question that should be on the forefront of their minds. What if the gunman never had access to an assault weapon? I want that question to be the first thing to cross their morning, their mind in the morning, and the last thought they have before they go to bed each night. Because we are no longer asking for change. We are demanding it, and we are angry as hell.
And a clarification on a previous headline, President Biden will become the first U.S. president to fly directly from Israel to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, not the first U.S. president to visit Jeddah. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Biden arrived in Israel Wednesday for a four-day visit that includes a stop in Saudi Arabia. Israel's interim prime minister, Yair Lapid, held a red carpet ceremony as Biden landed in Tel Aviv, giving him what the New York Times called a rapturous welcome, calling him our brother Joseph. Meanwhile, Biden vowed to deepen Israel's ties with the U.S.
Now, as president, I'm proud to say that our relationship with the state of Israel is deeper and stronger, in my view, than it's ever been. And with this visit, we're strengthening our connections even further. We have reaffirmed the unshakable commitment of the United States to Israel's security, including partnering with Israel on the most cutting-edge defense systems in the world.
Today, President Biden met with Prime Minister Lapid about Iran's nuclear program and the war in Ukraine. The U.S. and Israel are expected to announce a joint declaration building on past calls to take military action to halt Iran's nuclear program. Biden and Lapid will also participate in the first ever, they just did, the first ever I2U2 virtual summit. I2U2 stands for India, Israel, the UAE, United States. That's along with Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Emirati President Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. On Friday, Biden will visit the occupied West Bank, meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Ahead of Biden's trip, activists hung banners in Bethlehem that read, "Mr. President, this is apartheid." This is Karim Gibran with the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem.
This campaign by B'Tselem, which involves hanging banners reading, "Mr. President, this is apartheid," identifies Israel as a country of apartheid. We hold the American administration responsible for supporting the Israeli apartheid regime. The United States of America, as a democratic country, should push for an end to this system.
Biden's first visit to the Middle East as president is also aimed at normalizing relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. On Friday, Biden will fly to Saudi Arabia for talks with Saudi officials, which we'll discuss more later in the broadcast. But first, the Middle East trip comes as the Biden administration is facing pressure to scrap plans to build a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem after a Palestinian legal group revealed the proposed diplomatic compound is located on land that was illegally confiscated by Israel from Palestinians in 1948. The historical documents were made public by the Palestinian legal group Adala ahead of Biden's trip to Israel and the occupied West Bank. For more, we're joined by Rashid Khalidi, a Palestinian-American professor who's a descendant of some of the owners of these properties. Rashid Khalidi is Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, the author of a number of books, including his latest, The Hundred Years' War on Palestine. He's joining us from near Aix-en-Provence in France. Professor Khalidi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't we start there, around this issue of the proposed U.S. embassy, already very controversial, being built in Jerusalem, and the property that it is proposed to be built on?
Right. Well, as you mentioned, Adana, the Palestinian civil rights legal group based in Haifa, has come up with a bunch of new documents which show the ownership of our family and a number of other families of this land going back before 1948. In planning to build on our property and the property of all these other families, the U.S. government is actively engaged in infringing on the property rights of the legitimate owners of this land, who are U.S. citizens. So that, in a nutshell, is what's going on. This is something that wouldn't happen anywhere else in the world if a regime illegitimately seized the property of U.S. citizens.
Could you explain how it is that this land was chosen and what the families are calling for, including your own, of course?
Right. Well, it is a plot that is empty right now. Ever since 1948, until which it was the headquarters of the British military in Palestine. It was called the Allenby Barracks in those days. And until 1948, when the British military occupied it, and in fact, even after that, Britain paid all of the owners rent. Members of my family, my uncle Ghalib, my cousin Ikram, were receiving rent from the British government for this property well into the 1950s. So this is it's a large tract. It's more than 7 acres, and there are multiple owners, including my family.
We're actually showing the deeds. Can you explain what these are and what has been the response of the United States?
Well, it's interesting. These are things that Adala discovered in the Israeli archives, and what they are rental agreements between the Ministry of War, the British Ministry of War, and different families, or different owners of different families, Palestinian families, both Muslim and Christian. And so they're proof that this was property that was owned by these, by our family and these other families right up to 1948. And indeed, as I mentioned, I was talking to one of my cousins. She said her father was receiving rent from the British well into the 1950s. So this was our property. The British rented it from us and other families. Now, what the families are demanding is perfectly simple. We are demanding that the United States not build an embassy on our land. This is our property. It's not the property of the State of Israel to give or rent or lease to the United States. In fact, this has come up before. The Israeli government put through a plan to do this in the 1990s. And back in 1999, writing on behalf of the owners of this property, I wrote Secretary of State Albright in October 1999, in fact, providing the U.S. government with evidence of our ownership, collective ownership of this property. And we asked at that time that they, first of all, they not do this. And we asked for a meeting, which, of course, we never got. But we did get a response from the State Department many months after our original letter, in which they said they understood, they put the information on file. So our government knows that this is our property. And if they don't, they should know, because I wrote them a letter on behalf of the families back in October 1999. And we didn't send this new information. Adela has discovered new information. We sent the information that was in our possession at that time in 1999. And the plan stopped dead at that point, whether because of our intervention or for some other reason, I really don't know.
And Professor Khalidi, now, of course, Biden is there. Do you expect the question of the U.S. embassy to come up, the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, to come up at all?
Well, it should come up on at least two levels. By putting the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, the United States is violating resolutions of the United Nations that it voted for Jerusalem to be an international city, and for nothing to be done in Jerusalem that would jeopardize the final status of that city. So the United States is violating its own policies by building an embassy anywhere in Jerusalem. Moreover, they are infringing on the property rights of U.S. citizens in so doing. And so our demand is that they not do this, first of all. And we're all, obviously Adela will be going forward on behalf of the various families to try and make Israel obey its own laws, which say that if owners of so-called absentee property, that's basically stolen property. Let's use the correct term. The legal term in Israel is absentee property. There are members of my family living, you know, a kilometer away. So how are they absentees? But in any case, for the Israeli government to obey its own laws and for the custodian of absentee property, so-called, to return this property to its rightful owners. I don't expect that to happen, but I hope that during this visit, the president will be confronted, hopefully by a journalist or someone else, with the fact that the U.S. is about to build on land that belongs to U.S. citizens, among others.
Professor Haradi, Biden is expected to meet Palestinians tomorrow, possibly just Mahmoud Abbas, but he's expected not to revive peace discussions as previous presidents have done. Could you elaborate on that? What do we know of what's likely to be the focus of discussions tomorrow, Friday?
Well, I think that what the president is supposed to do, according to the news reports I've seen, is to throw a few charity bones to the Palestinians. This is an administration whose policy supposedly includes security and freedom for both Israelis and Palestinians. In fact, that means security and freedom for Israel, but not for Palestinians. By not engaging in dismantling the structures of discrimination and oppression, which someone rightly called apartheid, that Israel maintains, the United States is in fact supporting those structures. So by not launching a peace process, the United States is supporting a discriminatory, racist regime, which gives the Israelis rights to go to the beach anytime they want, but West Bank residents have to get permission from Israel. So Palestinians in their own country are arrested. My brother's son-in-law was arrested the other day simply for trying to go to the beach in his own country, why he didn't have a permit from Israel. That's the kind of racism, that's the kind of discrimination which the president, by not opening up all of these political issues, is in fact supporting with our tax dollars, with American diplomatic support, with American weapons. So I would hope that those issues are broached with the president. Those are the really important issues. Equality for Palestinians and Israelis, equality of security, equality in terms of freedom and rights. And that's what we don't have right now. We have a system of systemic, legalized inequality. Racist, discriminatory system.
So I wanted to ask you about Shireen Abu Akleh and all the latest developments. So many news organizations, from the New York Times to CNN to Al Jazeera, have investigated the killing, saying it was Israeli military that killed the famous Palestinian-American journalist who appears on Al Jazeera. Now, President Biden is visiting the Palestinian territories and meeting President Mahmoud Abbas on Friday. Professor Khalidi, we last spoke to you after Shireen Abu Akleh was shot dead during that Israeli army raid in the Jenin refugee camp in May. Ahead of Biden's trip to Israel, the family of Shireen Abu Akleh demanded Biden call out Israel over her killing. And in a letter to Biden, the family wrote, "Your administration's actions can only be seen as an attempt to erase the extrajudicial killing of Shireen and further entrench the systemic impunity enjoyed by Israeli forces and officials for unlawfully killing Palestinians," unquote. Now, yesterday, on Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken invited Shireen Abu Akleh's family to visit the United States. This is Shireen Abu Akleh's niece, Lina Abu Akleh, responding to the State Department's inconclusive findings after investigating the bullet that killed her.
"We were expecting that such an investigation would actually hold the perpetrators accountable and would carry out a transparent investigation that is free from any political pressure. However, that was not the case. We will continue to call for justice. We will continue to call on the U.S. to carry out a transparent investigation by an independent body. In addition, we continue to call on the U.N. and the ICC to carry out an investigation and hold Israel accountable and put an end to this grotesque impunity that Israel continues to endure."
Can you, Professor Halady, talk about the significance of what's happening here? Biden will not be meeting with the Palestinian-American journalist's family, but Blinken has invited them to Washington.
Well, I think that Nina Abate put it quite accurately. The State Department basically carried out a whitewash rather than an investigation. No Israeli soldiers, as far as we know, were interrogated by any American investigator. The people who looked into it, the person who looked into it was an American lieutenant general in the military, not trained investigators from, say, the FBI. There was no real investigation. There was a cover-up and a whitewash in order to guarantee Israel's impunity and to make sure that there wouldn't be any waves in the president's visit to Israel, which is the key part of what he's doing over these two or three days. He'll pay a courtesy visit on the president elected 17 years ago and who has no legitimacy in Ramallah, but it's really a visit to Israel. And so this whitewash was intended, I think, to make it easier in terms of American-Israeli relations. And what we're seeing here is yet another example of what sauce for the goose is not sauce for the gander. If an American citizen is killed or detained, if an American citizen's property is illegitimately taken, the United States government would normally do something about it. Here you have a case where a U.S. citizen was murdered, assassinated, according to every account by every investigation, the Washington Post, the New York Times, you mentioned several of them. And yet the U.S. government basically didn't do an investigation, pretended that it did, and said the issue's closed. Now, Blinken has generously offered to meet with the family. It's up to the family to respond to that. But the United States government has already taken the steps necessary to cover this up and to make sure that relations with Israel are not harmed. I think what should be demanded in every case is justice for U.S. citizens, as you would demand such justice anywhere else in the world. This is yet another American citizen killed by Israel. Rachel Corrie was murdered by an Israeli bulldozer. An aged Palestinian American died in Israeli custody when they shoved him in the mud, and he had a heart attack under detention with his hands tied behind his back in the West Bank about 9 months ago. So this is the third American citizen that we know about killed by the Israelis, about which the United States has done absolutely nothing. I don't think that if that happened in the Ukraine or if that happened somewhere else, we would see quite the same willingness to extend impunity to the government that was responsible for these actions.
Well, it's interesting. We're just about to go to Sarah Lee Whitson of Dawn to talk about this unprecedented trip, you know, the first U.S. president to fly from Israel to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, the country where the Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been directly implicated in the killing of the Washington Post columnist Khashoggi. So you go from Shireen Abu Akleh to Khashoggi.
There's a pattern there. American citizens can be killed with impunity by regimes that the United States wants to stay on good terms with. That's what's happening in Israel, and that's what's going to happen in Saudi Arabia.
Rashid Khalidi, I want to thank you for being with us. Edward Said, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including The 100 Years' War on Palestine. After Israel, Biden will head to Saudi Arabia, despite his campaign pledge to make Saudi Arabia a pariah for the state-sponsored killing of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. We'll go to Sarah Lee Whitson of Dawn, co-plaintiff with Khashoggi's fiancé in a lawsuit against the Saudi Arabian crown prince. Stay with us. نسرد قصتها بالعكس الجريمة للولادة جثتها قفزت من الحفرة لحفة الأرض طلعت العظم من جبينها وانبلعت بالفرد صدى صوتها صرخ وهي ردت عليك دموعها تصعد من الخد للعينين من ورا غيمة الدخان وجوه العيلة أخوها بلا خجل حط الفرد بالجيبة لأنها نزل المجراح ودهن عرق عشبينه بهزت راس اكتفى من القبر ومقاييسه جروها على السيارة هي تضرب أقدامها كعاصفة رمال تمحي أفر بعسادة دخلوها على البجاج مش عارفة لوين بس عارفة إنهم طلعوا طلعت الرجيل الدين وصلوا البيت رموها بعنف على التخيل بدك تهربي برا البلاد صحوها بطريقة We'll be right back.
نحلم نعكس حياة علينا برك نفهم هار بالسعادة تحرك من اليمين لليسار بتراجع خطواتها مثل اللي تاهت بمصارنا متجاهزة كم من ايش للتاكسي تذكرة وجواز سفر تحت الوسادة الجواب خلي الأوعي بالخزانة بتلبس حياة
If I could go back in time by Dam and Amal Mirkus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. On Friday, President Biden will continue. He will be making his first trip to the Middle East of his administration as he heads to Saudi Arabia for talks with Saudi officials and to attend a summit of Gulf allies. He's the first U.S. president to fly directly from Israel to the Saudi port city of Jeddah. He's expected to ask Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to pump more oil. The trip comes despite Biden's pledge during the presidential debate in 2019 to make Saudi Arabia pariah for the state-sponsored killing of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi.
President Trump has not punished senior Saudi leaders. Would you?
Yes. And I said it at the time. Khashoggi was, in fact, murdered and dismembered. And I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
That was then presidential candidate Joe Biden speaking in a debate in 2019. Before his trip, President Biden wrote an op-ed that appeared in the very paper where Jamal Khashoggi was a columnist, The Washington Post, titled, Why I'm Going to Saudi Arabia, saying, quote, In Saudi Arabia, we reversed the blank check policy we inherited. I released the intelligence community's report on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, issued new sanctions, including on the Saudi Arabia's rapid intervention force involved in his killing, and issued 76 visa bans under a new rule barring entry into the United States for anyone found to be involved in harassing dissidents abroad. My administration has made clear the United States will not tolerate extraterritorial threats and harassment against dissidents and activists by any government, he wrote. Last year, President Biden approved a $650 million arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Earlier this year, Biden signed off on the sale of $5 billion to weapons to Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. For more, we're joined by Sarah Lee Whitson, executive director of DAWN, that's Democracy for the Arab World Now, which is a co-plaintiff with Khashoggi's fiancé, Hatice Cengiz, in a lawsuit against the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, for Khashoggi's murder. Sarah Lee Whitson's recent piece in the American Prospect is headlined, America's Middle East Withdrawal Breathes Its Last Breath. Explain what you mean by America's Middle East Withdrawal, Sarah Lee Whitson.
Well, successive administrations have talked about their desire to pivot to Asia to address the threats from China and Russia, to end America's entanglements in armed conflicts in the Middle East, going back, of course, to the Iraq War, but more recently, the Yemen War. And I think the Biden administration genuinely believed that it could use the momentum of mass bipartisan popular revulsion at Saudi crimes to, in fact, end the deep, deep entanglement with Saudi Arabia and the UAE in particular, but also Egypt, where he promised to end blank checks, and build on that momentum to fulfill a national security priority, which is to disentangle ourselves from the abusive regimes of the Middle East. That hasn't happened. He has, in fact, reversed and gone full force, doubling down in an unprecedented way in the wake of the war in Ukraine to recommit and drastically expand America's military support for the most abusive regimes in the Middle East, in particular Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
And can you explain, Sarah Lee, what exactly is this imminent, reportedly imminent defense alliance that the new U.S. is negotiating or discussing with Saudi Arabia as well as with the UAE?
Well, I wish I could tell you more, other than we know that this defense agreement is probably actually completed, if you believe the Israeli prime minister, who said that the agreement is already signed and being implemented and has already been implemented, according to the Israeli prime minister, former Israeli prime minister now, to shield off attacks The defense agreement, as far as we know, at minimum includes unified air defenses, unified intelligence sharing, a unified reaction to aerial threats. What it obligates the United States to do, what exactly the commitments are that President Biden is making to the autocracies and apartheid governments of the Middle East, we don't know because he hasn't told us. And I believe that the reason the Biden administration is keeping this secret from the American people is the same reason he penned that op-ed in the Washington Post. It's shameful. He knows it's shameful. If it was something to be proud about, they would have been boasting about it to the rafters. He knows that it is a conciliatory, humiliating capitulation to the Gulf governments and to Israel in order to win them back as reassuring them that the United States has their back no matter what.
Sara Lee, this is perhaps especially striking because, as you point out in your piece in Prospect Magazine, the Saudis appear to have repeatedly spurned U.S. demands with respect to Russia following their invasion of Ukraine. Could you elaborate on that? And the United Arab Emirates has not been any more forthcoming.
Well, I think across the board, it's not just in the Middle East, you have seen much of the world turn its back on the United States in terms of its demand for unquestioned support to fight against Russia. This does not coincide with their interests. And in the case of the Middle East, in the case of Saudi Arabia, in the case of UAE, two governments that depend entirely on U.S. military protection for their survival, they refused. The UAE refused to support a UN Security Council resolution to sanction Russia. And they only agreed to a toothless General Assembly resolution condemning the invasion after a great deal of pressure from the United States and some of its European allies. They, of course, are not parties to the sanctions on Russia. And just recently, we have had the head of state in the UAE travel to Russia. We know that they have continued to host numerous fleeing Russian oligarchs and to house their giant yachts, and that they have deep, deep property investments in Dubai. So while these Gulf states demand that we support them in their conflicts, they have done not even the barest minimum to reciprocate and show support for the war against Russia.
So what is your response to President Biden clearly going to Saudi Arabia to lower prices at the gas pump? Tell us about the latest in the investigation to Khashoggi and Dawn's lawsuit together with the Khashoggi, Jamal Khashoggi's fiance, against the Crown Prince. Where does the Biden administration stand on this?
Well, I guess taking your question, your first question first, in terms of Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia, I think it's very important to emphasize that no one is demanding that that the United States cut off relations with Saudi Arabia, quote unquote, rupture relations with Saudi Arabia. What we are demanding, what many others are demanding, is that we normalize our abnormal relationship with Saudi Arabia, which entails unmatched political and military support in terms of arms sales alone. What we are demanding is that we distance ourselves from supporting militarily a psychopathic madman who has been responsible for the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people in Yemen. This does not serve America's interest. It does not serve America's interest to prop up an unaccountable, unelected, sociopathic murderer who will be around for decades to come once he gets the security agreement in particular. With respect to Don's lawsuit with Khadija Genghis against Mohammed bin Salman and his co-conspirators, the judge just last week asked the Biden administration to weigh in on whether or not they want to grant immunity to Mohammed bin Salman from our lawsuit, immunity that he should not be entitled to because he is not head of state. His father, King Salman, is the head of state. And so we are waiting to see whether the Biden administration will really go as far as not the opposite of what Biden promised, not to hold Mohammed bin Salman accountable, but to make sure that he is immune from accountability in the one remaining lawsuit to hold him accountable for this murder. I think that would be shocking and unprecedented. U.S. courts have ruled in the past that crown princes are not entitled to sovereign immunity. If the Biden administration creates new law by asking the court to grant him immunity, that will be a really shocking stab in the back. And of course, a total break of President Biden's own promises.
Sarah Lee, you mentioned the question of arms sales in your piece. You also say, of course, that Saudi Arabia is the largest importer of U.S. weapons. You point out in the piece that both Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin have, quote, deep and longstanding commercial and personal ties to the defense industry. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, Secretary Blinken, of course, has yet to disclose what is widely known to be arms industry clients during his prior commercial venture in an investment advisory firm that he managed and ran. Of course, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin sits on the board, until he became secretary, I believe, of Raytheon, I'm pretty sure, and of course, has longstanding ties with the defense industry. We have to understand that the defense industry, 70% of the lobbyists in the defense industry are former defense Pentagon and U.S. Government officials. The ties to the highest levels of the government are very deep and very profound. The entire incentive system of the U.S. government in terms of foreign policy is to continue arms sales, push arms sales as much as possible. When you couple that incentive structure of intense lobbying and intertwining and conflict of interest of our elected officials with the defense industry, coupled with the foreign government lobbying and the foreign government influence infiltration into our government, not least, of course, is Israeli government lobbying and support of their lobbying partners here in the United States, but widely expanded Saudi government lobbying and infiltration, Emirati government lobbying and infiltration. You have a very, very strong incentive structure for any administration to always go back to more arms sales, more protection for dictators and apartheid governments, despite the America's national interest. I think this is very, very little about oil. First of all, the Biden administration has already told us that even if Saudi and UAE increase oil output, which, by the way, they've said they'll do, it will have a negligible impact on oil prices in the United States. Second of all, if oil prices are such a priority for the Biden administration that they are willing to go and kiss and make up and resume support for the worst dictators in the world, why not remove sanctions on Venezuela and Iran? That would ease up oil prices potentially as well. Why not ease up on sanctions on Russian oil? That's not necessary in terms of this war. If we're willing to sacrifice for oil prices, there are much less heinous sacrifices to be making than to continue military support for the governments of Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
We only have a minute. Can you talk about the fact that family members of those detained on charges of dissent in Saudi Arabia are hoping that Biden will make efforts towards their release? What do you expect will happen? And of course, Saudi Arabia denies that there are any people imprisoned as political prisoners in the kingdom.
Well, we know that the Biden administration has asked what the human rights community would like Biden to do. And our organization has indeed asked President Biden to meet with families of activists who are detained or recently released activists in Saudi Arabia as a show of support for civil society in the country. We doubt very much that he will do any of that in Saudi Arabia, nor do we have much faith that American demands for human rights reforms in Saudi Arabia, including the release of imprisoned scholars, academics, writers, journalists in the country, will be heard by Mohammed bin Salman. We can expect Mohammed bin Salman to respond exactly as he did reportedly in meeting with Jake Sullivan, which is to tell him to shut up. You know, shut up. because he doesn't want to hear it. And he has already made clear a demand that he does not want to be questioned ever again about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, or, for example, where his body is hidden, what they have done with Jamal's remains. And President Biden just today said, well, I'm not going to bring up Jamal Khashoggi because I've already said what I have to say on that. Beautiful, inartful dodge. And so that is, I think, very indicative of the fact that President Biden will do very little to help imprisoned Saudi activists, some of whom are facing the death penalty because they criticized the prince.
Sarah Lee Whitson, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Dawn Democracy for the Arab World Now. We'll link to your piece, American Prospect, headlined America's Middle East Withdrawal Breathe Its Last Breath. Next up is BA5, the reinfection wave. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize winning science writer Ed Yong of The Atlantic in 30 seconds.
If you say real talk, I probably won't trust you. If you want to go to war, the guns, my pleasure. Even Jesus had 12 disciples on the lever, trigger, whatever.
Walk It Out remix by DJ Unk featuring Outkast. The song by the Atlanta-based artist was blasted by Amazon warehouse workers in Atlanta Wednesday as they walked out of their jobs to demand higher wages and more of a focus on safety during Amazon's Prime Week. Meanwhile, workers, Amazon's German warehouses also went on a Prime Day strike in recent days, calling for good and healthy work. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're now about 2.5 years into the coronavirus pandemic, and health experts said this week the most infectious and transmissible COVID-19 is now a global health emergency. This is World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus speaking Tuesday at a virtual news conference in Geneva.
I'm concerned that cases of COVID-19 continue to rise, putting further pressure on stretched health systems and health workers, and also concerned about the increasing trend of deaths. The Emergency Committee on COVID-19 met on Friday last week and concluded that the virus remains a public health emergency of international concern.
For more, we're joined by Ed Yong, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer at The Atlantic. His new piece is headlined as BA5, The Reinfection Wave. Ed, welcome back to Democracy Now! Well, is it? Explain exactly what it is and the level of hospitalization and deaths.
So BA5 is the latest version of the Omicron family of variants to hit the U.S., it is displacing its predecessor, BA2, and it is indeed causing a surge. BA5's most important property is its ability to sneak past some of the immune defenses acquired by people either who've been vaccinated before or who have experienced, who've been infected by earlier variants. And that means that everyone is now a little less protected than they were a few months ago. Some people who have even recently been infected are getting infected again. Now, this doesn't mean that previous immunity is back down to zero, far from it. People who have some degree of immunity from past infection or vaccination still have some protection against infection, even from BA5. But it's less than before, which is why we're seeing more reinfections now than before. The good news is that the most severe outcomes, things like being sick enough to warrant an intubator, needing oxygen, and of course dying, the vaccines do seem to still be protecting against those. But it's still important to prevent infections. I think that a lot of this country, including its highest political echelons, have seemed to have forgotten that basic goal. Preventing infections is really important for preventing long COVID, for sparing the healthcare system, for all this and more. And because of that, BA5 is still very much a problem.
So could you explain, Ed, why you think the Biden administration has made the decisions that it has with respect to COVID and restrictions, and why it's so important? I mean, you've said a little right now, why it's so important to focus on infections when, as you say, vaccination and prior infection do provide some degree of immunity against severe illness.
Yeah, I think for much of the last year plus, the Biden administration's posture has been moving towards an era of individual responsibility. It really is down to you specifically to take actions that will protect yourself, rather than what I think is true, which is that it's the government's job to protect the health of entire populations. This is indeed the goal of public health more generally. It's to protect entire communities and the most vulnerable among them first. I don't think that this is what the administration is currently doing. And it has taken up this posture of preventing the most severe outcomes, so severe hospitalizations and deaths, and to taken its foot off the pedal in terms of preventing infections. But preventing infections still really matters. And there are loads of reasons for that. Firstly, people can still get long COVID. People can be disabled by months or even years of lingering symptoms. And often, within such cases, these were, quote unquote, mild infections. They were infections that weren't sending people to hospital, but were nonetheless incapacitating them. There's also the fact that the healthcare system is still kind of broken, right? It has been severely infected by the last 2+ years of the pandemic. A lot of healthcare workers have resigned, and those who are remaining in their jobs are exhausted and demoralized. This is not a system that can handle the same kind of pressures that it could several years ago, and it cannot more and more surges of the kind that we are still experiencing.
A New York Times article. I wanted to ask you, a New York Times article earlier this week was headlined as Six COVID Wave Hits, Many New Yorkers Shrug It Off. Your article argues it is a terrible approach with a city as densely populated as New York City, where everyone uses public transportation, all public spaces are crowded. Talk about the kind of protective measures that are needed. I was in the subway last night. Through my mask, I said, you know, you should be wearing a mask. More than half of the people weren't. People looked at me blankly, maybe because they were just listening to their headphones and couldn't hear me. But, I mean, it is a complete change in a city where actually people were wearing masks. And it's actually still required in the subway, but people have just given up on it.
Yeah, and I think that there is this vicious cycle going on where our political leaders and, indeed, our media, as per the article you mentioned, have claimed that everyone is past the pandemic. People then rightly think, okay, we've been told that it's over, and those two things feed off each other. And yet, until pretty recently, support for things like masking, support for measures that would protect large groups of people, was actually still very high. There's been this sort of self-defeating process where we've told ourselves people are past it, and people are like, we're past it? Okay, I guess we're past it. The measures that we need are still the same as before, regardless of whether it's BA5 or BA2 or the original Omicron. Firstly, vaccinations obviously are still massively important. Not enough people are boosted, and that remains a crucial part of protecting all of us from infection and severe outcomes. Masking remains really important, and I think mandates can still help. Like, we need people to be masking up in public places where people are gathering. Things like ventilation have really never been taken into account seriously throughout the pandemic. This virus spreads through the air between people, and we need better policies that can improve ventilation in all kinds of public settings. Instead of actually pushing for these kinds of measures, as well as things like testing, paid sick leave and other social supports, a lot of that is going away. COVID funding has been stalled in Congress for a long time. And so even some of the meager protections we already have, the sort of the testing infrastructure and vaccine infrastructure that was in place, are starting to be dismantled right now. And yet, as we've seen, this is just going to keep happening, right? We are now locked in this perpetual cat and mouse game between the virus and our existing immunity. Our immunity builds up across the population, a new variant arises to erode it, the immunity will build up again, a new variant will emerge again. We're going to see this keep on happening, and we either choose to continue ignoring and forfeiting this game, or we will finally, or to finally take it seriously. Those are our choices, and we can still choose to be better at this.
Ed, could you talk about, do you think that one of the priorities, I mean, it's still the case, rather shockingly, that one in three Americans are still not vaccinated at all. Do you think that that should also be a priority? And also, is it, I mean, obviously, much of the world outside the Euro-American world has yet to receive sufficient vaccines to vaccinate their populations. What role does that play in the development and spread of these variants and subvariants? If more people are vaccinated, will there be fewer variants?
I think it will help. Vaccines, as I said, are really important. But I don't think that, I think the mistake that this administration has made for at least over a year is to assume that vaccines alone are going to do all the work for us. They do a lot of the heavy lifting, but they're not going to bring the pandemic to an end by itself, by themselves. We need to put in all the other measures that people have been calling for the longest time. We need cleaner air. We need a stronger social safety net so people can take care of their own health without risking the health of their families or their co-workers. We have needed all of those things from the start. And I think America's problem is that it assumes that it can just tech its way out of these problems, that once it develops the vaccine, things are fine. As we've seen, you can have great vaccines, and they're not going to make the difference that they should if there's a population that simply doesn't trust them, that won't decide to get them, where getting them is difficult. It's this field of dreams approach where we say if we build it, they will come. And if you have a population with weak social safety nets, with weak trust in each other and government, that's just not going to work. Like there's a sort of a fundamental deficit in American society that needs to be addressed, like right now, to make sure that these kinds of biomedical interventions actually work in the way that people hope that they will do.
Ed, we are going to continue after the show to do a post-show with you and your new book. Your new book is just out. It's called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. But give us a tease, a synopsis. You also wrote a piece for the called How Animals See Themselves.
Yeah, so the book is about the wondrous ways in which animals perceive the world around us. So every creature, whether it's a human or an elephant or a dog, is trapped in its own sensory bubble, the Umwelt. It can perceive certain sights and sounds and textures, but those are going to be very different to what other creatures are experiencing. So I can't smell the world in the way my dog Typo can. I can't sense the magnetic field of the earth in the way the sparrows outside my window can. I can't sense electric fields in the way a shark or a platypus can. This book is about expanding people's idea of the world around them to show what other animals can perceive. And by that, I hope that it shows the world that they thought they knew in a completely new and magical light. Like when I walk the neighborhood with my dog, I get to understand all the things that he's smelling that I don't. And that means that even mundane aspects of my life become newly magical.
Well, Ed, we're going to continue this discussion because the book is magical. Ed Yong, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer at The Atlantic. His new book is called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. And we'll link to your piece in The Atlantic. That latest piece is BA5, the reinfection wave. That does it for our show. You can get that interview at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzda, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker. I'm Trina Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, our Executive Director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
Hi, I'm Melinda Crawford, a Scottish fiddler, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Mando!
Everybody ready?
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD, and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WTC and WTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from Keysport, Pennsylvania. I am your host, Mando Richard, and I've got quite the show planned. We're originating again from the studios of WRCT Pittsburgh, so it's not 100% predictable what's going to happen, but we've got a liquored up set at the beginning. We'll have a gospel set at the end, and who knows what will happen in between. Well, let's get the liquored up set started, shall we? Here come the Morgantown Rounders with Dance All Night with a Bottle in Your Hand.
Bottle in your hand, bottle in your hand, dance all night with the bottle in your hand, just for digging the fiddler dram. On a fence, ain't seen nothing on my job long since. Walked on home, couldn't get along. Here comes Sally with the pigtails on. She took it off and I put it on. Here comes Sally with the red dress on.